If you love true crime and dark stories, then you'll love our other podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia, with new episodes every Monday and Tuesday.
He told them that in the year prior to Bundy's move to Utah, she had discovered objects that she couldn't understand in her house and in Bundy's apartment. These items included crutches and a meat cleaver that was never used for cooking.
Just search Dark Side of Wikipedia wherever you download podcasts.
You know, then this guy gets rich and he has some issues with sexual addiction.
Yeah, and control. Yeah. The Keith Raniere story.
Dark Side of Wikipedia. Press subscribe wherever you download podcasts and don't miss a single episode.
In some ways, it starts to make things like Jeffrey Dahmer and that look tame, not in terms of the brutality of what they performed, but in terms of the psychology and manipulation of people.
Dark Side of Wikipedia. Available wherever you download podcasts. The man who broke barriers in the world of aviation, Charles Lindbergh. Also the man who would have his life torn apart and plagued by disaster as his child was kidnapped from his home in 1932. Who stole the Lindbergh baby and why? Who could do such an act of deplorable crimes against humanity? Today, the Lindbergh baby on the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
On March 1st, 1932, Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr., 20-month-old son of aviators Charles Lindbergh and Anne Morrow Lindbergh, was abducted from the crib in the upper floor of the Lindbergh's home in Highfields in East Amwell, New Jersey. On May 12th, the child's corpse was discovered by a truck driver by the side of a nearby road. In September 1934, a German immigrant carpenter named Bruno Richard Hauptmann was arrested for the crime. After a trial that lasted from January 2nd to February 13th, 1935, he was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to death. Despite his conviction, he continued to profess his innocence, but all appeals failed and he was executed in the electric chair at the New Jersey State Prison on April 3rd, 1936. Newspaper writer H.L. Mencken called the kidnapping and trial the biggest story since the resurrection. Legal scholars have referred to the trial as one of the trials of the century. The crime spurred Congress to pass the Federal Kidnapping Act, commonly called the Little Lindbergh Law, which made transporting a kidnapping victim across state lines a federal crime. At 7:30 p.m. on March 1st, 1932, the Lindbergh's nurse, Betty Gow, found that 20-month-old Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. was not with his mother, Anne Morrow Lindbergh, who had just come out of the bathtub. Gow then alerted Charles Lindbergh, who immediately went to the child's room, where he found a ransom note containing bad handwriting and grammar and an envelope on the windowsill. Taking a gun, Lindbergh went around the house and grounds with butler Ollie Watsley. They found impressions in the ground under the window of the baby's room, pieces of a cleverly designed wooden ladder, and a baby's blanket. Watley telephoned the Hopewell Police Department, and Lindbergh contacted his attorney and friend, Henry Breckenridge, of the New Jersey State Police. Hopewell Borough Police and New Jersey State Police officers conducted an extensive search of the home and its surrounding area. After midnight, a fingerprint expert examined the ransom note and ladder. No usable fingerprints or footprints were found, leading experts to conclude that the kidnappers wore gloves and had some type of cloth on the soles of their shoes. No adult fingerprints were found in the baby's room, including the areas witness admitted to touching, such as a window, but the baby's fingerprints were found. The brief handwritten ransom note had many spelling and grammar irregularities. So it's the Dark Side of Wikipedia, the Lindbergh baby story. And this is one I have to admit, you know, I've heard about, but I don't know many of the details of. So I'm really excited to kind of dive into exactly what went down with this. It's Tony and Carol Hughes on the episode today. If you like our program, you want access to all the archives and all that, and bonus parts of the show, the final chapters, check it out at darksideofwiki.com and help keep us on the air. What's your thoughts, knowledge, and all that on Lindbergh's case?
Well, it's been so long since I've read anything about this or seen anything about it mm-hmm. that I don't remember anything about the person who was arrested or the trial. So it's going to be like all new to me, mm-hmm. that part. But, you know, I mean, kidnapping a 20-month-year-old baby, mm-hmm. that's just sick. That is so sick.
Yeah.
And at the time, Charles Lindbergh was very beloved.
Yeah.
You know, he was like a national hero. Well, maybe more than national. I mean, he was worldwide famous.
It'd be like kidnapping Tom Hanks' kid.
Right.
You know, in today's world of celebrity.
Although Tom Hanks went and did the, you know, inaugural thing.
Yeah.
So now there's probably half the country hates him.
Yeah.
But that's all it takes these days.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was so beloved, and the fact that someone could do something like that to him and just the outrage of the country. And I think that, you know, that was one of those things that the whole country was in shock.
Yeah.
Over. But I was watching a show over the weekend. I'm not going to say the name of the show because I'm not giving anything away. But in the show that I was watching, there was a child kidnapped. And I was like, that's such a horrible thing to do.
And
like,
very,
I can't even wrap my brain around that.
And a very weird plot line for the Connors. It was like, I don't know why they were.
I was like, Roseanne's poor child got kidnapped.
And somehow she gave birth from beyond the grave, which was even weirder.
And it was a rerun because she was still on there. And I was like, how did I never see that episode before? Anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was Roseanne. That's what I was watching. And, yeah, but I was thinking, I just thought about that over the weekend. Like, that is a certain kind of evil to do that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because that's trying to take away, you know, just take away a part of that person's soul.
Yeah.
Something they would never, ever recover from. Like, that's just so horrific.
It's evil. I mean, there's...
And I just don't know, like, and that's why I'm going to be interested into this person who was arrested. Like, because did they really think he did it? You know, or was it one of those things where we got to arrest somebody?
Yeah, because the country's begging for the villain to be identified. And how many times does that happen? So
I don't remember that part. So that'll be interesting.
Let's jump back into it. We're going to pick up with the actual letter that the ransom note that was left at the Lindbergh home. And keep in mind, it is grammatically very messed up. So I'm not misreading. I'm going to do my best to read this misread letter as it was written. Dear sir, have 50.000 ready, $25,000 in $20 bills, and $15,000 in $10 bills, and $10,000 in $5 bills. After 2 to 4 days, we will inform you where to deliver the money. Many of these words spelled incorrectly as well. We warn you for making anything public, for notify the police the child is in gut care. Indication for all letters, our signature, and 3 holes. At the bottom of the note were 2 incorrected blue circles surrounding a red circle with a hole punched through the red circle and 2 more holes to the left and right. Word of the kidnapping spread quickly. Hundreds of people converged on the estate, destroying any footprint evidence, along with police, well-connected and well-intentioned people arriving at the Lindbergh estate. Military colonels offered their aid, although only one had law enforcement experience, Herbert Norman Schwarzkopf, superintendent of the New Jersey State Police. The other colonels were Henry Skillman Breckinridge, a Wall Street lawyer, and William J. Donovan, a hero of the First World War, who would later head the Office of Strategic Services. A forerunner of the CIA, Lindbergh and these men speculated that the kidnapping was perpetrated by organized crime figures. They thought that the letter was written by someone who spoke German as his native language. At this time, Charles Lindbergh used his influence to control the direction of the investigation. They contacted Mickey Rosner, a Broadway hanger-on rumored to know mobsters. Rosner turned to two speakeasy owners, Salvatore Salvi Spitale and Irving Bitz, for aid. Lindbergh quickly endorsed the duo and appointed them as intermediaries to deal with the mob. Several organized crime figures, notably Al Capone, Willie Moretti, Joe Adonis, and Abner Zwillman, spoke from prison, offering to help return the baby in exchange for money or for legal favors. Specifically, Capone offered assistance in return for being released from prison under the pretense that his assistance would be more effective. This was quickly denied by the authorities. The morning after the kidnapping, authorities notified President Herbert Hoover of the crime. At that time, kidnapping was classified as a state crime, and the case did not seem to have any grounds for federal involvement. Attorney General William D. Mitchell met with Hoover and announced that the whole machinery of the Department of Justice would be set in motion to cooperate with the New Jersey authorities. The FBI was authorized to investigate the case, while the United States Coast Guard, the U.S. Customs Service, the U.S. Immigration Services, and the Washington, D.C. Police were told their services might be required. New Jersey officials announced a $25,000 reward for the safe return of Little Lindy. The Lindbergh family offered an additional $50,000 reward of their own. At the time, this total reward of $75,000 would approximately be equivalent to $1,172,000 today. It was a tremendous sum of money because our nation was in the midst of the Great Depression. On March 6, a new ransom letter arrived by mail at the Lindbergh home. The letter was postmarked March 4th in Brooklyn. It carried the perforated red and blue marks. The ransom had been raised to $70,000. A third ransom note, postmarked from Brooklyn, and also included the secret marks, arrived in Breckinridge's mail. The note told the Lindberghs that John Condon should be the intermediary between the Lindberghs and the kidnappers, and requested notification in a newspaper that the third note had been received. Instructions specified the size of the box the money should come in and warned the family not to contact the police. During this time, John F. Condon, a well-known Bronx personality and retired schoolteacher, offered $1,000 if the kidnapper would turn the child over to a Catholic priest. Condon received a letter reportedly written by the kidnappers. It authorized Condon to be their intermediary with Lindbergh. Lindbergh accepted the letter as genuine. Following the kidnapper's latest instructions, Condon placed a classified ad in the New York American reading, "Money is ready, Jeff C." Condon then waited for further instructions from the culprits. The meeting between Jaffe and a representative of the group that claimed to be the kidnappers was eventually scheduled for late one evening at Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. According to Condon, the man sounded foreign, but stayed in the shadows during the conversation, and Condon was thus unable to get a close look at his face. The man said his name was John. He was relating his story. He was a Scandinavian sailor, part of a gang of three men and two women. The baby was being held on a boat, unharmed, but would be returned only for ransom. When Condon expressed doubt that John actually had the baby, he promised some proof. The kidnapper would soon return the baby's sleeping suit. The stranger asked Condon, "Would I burn if a package were dead?" When questioned further, he assured Condon that the baby was alive. On March 16th, Condon received a toddler's sleeping suit by mail and a seventh ransom note. After Lindbergh identified the sleeping suit, Condon placed a new ad in the home news. "Money is ready, no cops, no secret service. I come alone like last time." On April 1st, Condon received a letter saying it was time for the ransom to be delivered. So, they really, you know, they're in the cemetery with the guy standing behind the tree and having all of this go down. I mean, I'm really kind of amazed that it went down like that. I don't know that would happen today.
Well, and there's a lot of interesting things, like the fact that they reached out to the mob right away.
Yeah.
But I guess it was a different time, so maybe the idea was maybe if the mob did it, and I don't know why they would, that's not really addressed, for money, I guess. But I guess they needed some connections in that world. I just think that's so weird. Now, if, you know, unless you were connected with the mob, and I don't think Charles Lindbergh was. I don't know. Maybe it won't. But the whole thing is just like right out of a movie.
Yeah.
And the fact that then they did send back the kid, what the kid was sleeping in.
Which that would just make you sick knowing, oh my God, you know. This is real. They have the kid. But then you also wonder, you know, is the kid alive? Because they still could be making it up that he's even alive, you know.
Right.
And, yeah. Let's continue into...
That'd be so horrifying.
Yeah, I cannot contemplate. Let's continue into the story. The ransom was packaged in a wooden box that was custom made in the hope that it could later be identified. The ransom money included a number of gold certificates. Since gold certificates were about to be withdrawn from circulation, it was hoped greater attention would be drawn to anyone spending them. The bills were not marked, but their serial numbers were recorded. Some sources credit the idea to Frank J. Wilson, others to Elmer Lincoln Irie. On April 2nd, Condon was given a note by an intermediary, an unknown cab driver. Condon met John and told him that they had been able to raise only $50,000. The man accepted the money and gave Condon a note saying that the child was in the care of two innocent women. On May 12th, delivery truck driver Orville Wilson and his assistant William Allen pulled to the side of the road about 4.5 miles south of Lindbergh's home near the hamlet of Mount Rose in the neighboring Hopewell Township. When Allen went into the grove of trees to urinate, he discovered the body of a toddler. The skull was badly fractured and the body decomposed, having been chewed on by animals. There were indications of an attempt at a hasty burial. Gow identified the baby as the missing infant from the overlapping toes of the right foot and a shirt that she had made. It appeared the child had been killed by a blow to the head. Lindbergh insisted on cremation. In June 1932, officials began to suspect that the crime had been perpetrated by someone the Lindberghs knew. Suspicion fell upon Violet Sharp, a British household servant at the Murrow home, who had given contradictory information regarding her whereabouts on the night of the kidnapping. It was reported that she appeared nervous and suspicious when questioned. She committed suicide on June 10, 1932, by ingesting a silver polish that contained cyanide just before being questioned for the fourth time. Her alibi was later confirmed to the police and were criticized for their heavy heartedness. Condon was also questioned by police and his home searched, but nothing suggestive was found. Charles Lindbergh stood by Condon during this time. John Condon's unofficial investigation. After the discovery of the body, Condon remained unofficially involved in the case. To the public, he had become a suspect and in some circles was vilified. For the next 2 years, he visited police departments and pledged to find Cemetery John. Condon's actions regarding the case were increasingly flamboyant. On one occasion, when riding a city bus, Condon claimed that he saw a suspect on the street and, announcing his secret identity, ordered the bus to stop. The startled driver complied and Condon darted from the bus, although his target eluded him. Condon's actions were also criticized as exploitative when he agreed to appear in a vaudeville act regarding the kidnapping. Liberty Magazine published a serialized account of Condon's involvement in the Lindbergh kidnapping under the title Japsy Tells All. The investigators who were working on the case were still at a standstill. There were no developments and little evidence of any sort, so police turned their attention to tracking the ransom payments. A pamphlet was prepared with the serial numbers on the ransom bills, and 250,000 copies were distributed to businesses, mainly in New York City. A few of the ransom bills appeared in scattered locations, some as far away as Chicago and Minneapolis, but those spending the bills were never found. By a presidential order, all gold certificates were to be exchanged for other bills by May 1, 1933. A few days before the deadline, a man brought $2,980 to a Manhattan bank for exchange. It was later realized the bills were from the ransom. He had given his name as J.J. Faulkner of 537 West 149th Street. No one named Faulkner lived at that address. And a Jane Faulkner, who had lived there 20 years earlier, denied involvement. During a 30-month period, a number of ransom bills were spent throughout New York City. Detectives realized that many of the bills were being spent along the route of the Lexington Avenue subway, which connected the Bronx to the east side of Manhattan, including the German-Austrian neighborhood of Yorkville. On September 18, 1934, a Manhattan bank teller noticed a gold certificate from the ransom. A New York license plate number penciled on the bill's margin allowed it to be traced to a nearby gas station. The station manager had written down the license number because his customer was acting suspicious and was possibly a counterfeiter. The license plate belonged to a sedan owned by Richard Hoffman of 1279 East 222nd Street in the Bronx, an immigrant with a criminal record in Germany. When Hoffman was arrested, he was carrying a single $20 gold certificate, and over $14,000 of them, of the ransom money, was found in his garage. Hoffman was arrested, interrogated, and beaten at least once throughout the following day and night. Hoffman said that the money and other items had been left with him by his friend and former business partner, Isidore Fisch. Fisch had died on March 29, 1934, shortly after returning to Germany. Hoffman stated he learned only after Fisch's death that the shoebox that was left with him contained a considerable sum of money. He kept the money because he claimed that it was owed to him from a business deal that he and Fisch had made. Hoffman consistently denied any connection to the crime or knowledge that the money in his house was from the ransom. So, it's interesting when you look back into history and what potential there was to get away with things. Like, it was just, okay, what's your address? This is it. What's your, okay, great, thank you, next. And you could so easily lie about anything because there wasn't verification of so many things. And my God, I mean, if you wanted to be a criminal back then, it really wouldn't have been that complicated to get away with shit.
No, and if you had all that money, why not just move?
Yeah.
Like, if you moved to Omaha, they probably wouldn't have been looking for that money there. Like, it'd have been easy to spend the money.
Yeah.
I mean, I just use Omaha as an example, not that they're bad people.
Yeah, my go-to is Paducah, Kentucky. I don't know why. It's like, if you're
you
in Paducah.
Go to Paducah.
And you know I've driven through Paducah many times, like, on accident. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in Paducah. And it's actually it's much larger than I thought it was. It's a pretty.
And it's pretty.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's very green, very, very pretty. So I kind of feel bad for it always kind of being my middle of the road city that I just kind of throw out there. But anyway, yeah, I mean, that's the thing though. I think it would be so easy to go down that road. And there were plenty of very intelligent people who did. I mean, that's how you had organized crime and things of that nature. But you have a lot of just dumb criminals, too, where they're not going to, you know, they may be able to pull off the crime, but then living with what they did and what they've achieved, if you will, or got from the crime, that's where it gets screwed up.
But it also doesn't make sense to me that if you did do the crime, and you've got the money, and you just kind of spend it willy-nilly, like, oh, there's no way they'll ever track this.
Yeah.
And especially if there's gold notes in there,
mm-hmm.
and they're not widely used, wouldn't you look at that and go, oh, they're setting me up? You know, and you still have $14,000. I mean, you could have spent something else. It just seems so reckless.
Yeah.
You know, but then it's also very convenient that $14,000 was left at your house and by a guy who supposedly took off and went back to Germany. Why wouldn't he take that money?
And he died.
Yeah, he's dead.
Exactly. Like, and I don't know where this goes. And I know this is, I mean, there's many that know this whole case. I don't. So I'm kind of almost listening to this like it's a Dateline story. And I'm like, ooh, what's going to happen next?
No, me too.
Because I don't know
you
where this goes.
You did give away a little bit at the very beginning. I think we know how this guy ends up.
Oh, I don't know how he ends up. I know the baby's dead. But I guess I don't even remember what I said about this guy. At the
you
beginning.
Said something about an electric chair.
Oh, yeah. But I don't remember the name.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was this guy. Anyway,
I think it
I'm not good at remembering names. And that, see, it comes.
That makes it even more exciting for you then.
It is. It's like, it truly is. I guess there's some aspects of not remembering certain things that really can make things more exciting. There you go. It's like there's
well, there've been a lot of names in this story.
I couldn't. If somebody walked into my office and said their name within 5 minutes, I will have forgotten it.
Carol, that, who? That's yeah. your last name? Do I know you?
Hal, most of the people we worked with at the radio station, I didn't know their names.
Well, because they wouldn't be there very long.
Yeah, I mean, there was some. I mean, the long-term ones I knew, but there was plenty. I mean, I was always so afraid of, like, what's her name? And I was afraid I would say the wrong name. And then when I'm, like, on the spot, I just kind of, like, freeze up and my mind just goes blank. I'm just like that. But I don't know. But when I'm behind a mic, I'm not. I guess it's my fear of humans or something. I don't know. I'm not afraid. I'm fine with people, but I just kind of, I've always been like that. 85, I'm going to give the phone number. We continue on with the story here on the dark side of Wikipedia as they begin to search Hauptmann's home. Let's see what they find. When the police searched Hauptmann's home, they found a considerable amount of additional evidence that linked him to the crime. One item was a notebook that contained a sketch of the construction of a ladder similar to that which was found at the Lindbergh home in March 1932. John Connon's telephone number, along with his address, were discovered written on a closet wall in the house. A key piece of evidence, a section of wood, was discovered in the attic of the home. After being examined by an expert, it was determined to be an exact match to the wood used in the construction of the ladder found at the scene of the crime. Hauptmann was indicted in the Bronx on September 24, 1934, for extorting $50,000 ransom from Charles Lindbergh. 2 weeks later, on October 8th, Hauptmann was indicted in New Jersey for the murder of Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. 2 days later, he was surrendered to New Jersey authorities by New York Governor Hubert H. Lehman to face charges directly related to the kidnapping and murder of the child. Hauptmann was moved to the Hunterdon County Jail in Flemington, New Jersey, on October 19th. Hauptmann was charged with capital murder. The trial was held at the Hunterdon County Courthouse in Flemington, New Jersey, and was soon dubbed the Trial of the Century. Reports swarmed the town, and every hotel room was booked. Judge Thomas Whitaker Trenchard presided over the trial in exchange for rights to publish Hauptmann's story in their newspaper. Edward J. Riley was hired by the New York Daily Mirror to serve as Hauptmann's attorney. David T. Wilns, Attorney General of New Jersey, led the prosecution. Evidence against Hauptmann include $20,000 of the ransom money found in his garage and testimony alleging that his handwriting and spelling were similar to those of the ransom notes. 8 handwriting experts, including Albert S. Osborne, pointed out similarities between the ransom notes and Hauptmann's writing specimens. The defense called an expert to rebut this evidence, while 2 others declined to testify. The latter 2 demanded $500 before looking at the notes and were dismissed when Lloyd Fisher, a member of Hauptmann's legal team, declined. Other experts retained by the defense were never called to testify. On the basis of the work of Arthur Kollner at the Forest Productions Laboratory, the state introduced photographs demonstrating that part of the wood from the ladder matched a plank from the floor of Hauptmann's attic. The type of wood, the direction, the tree growth, the milling pattern, the inside and outside surface of the wood, and the grain on both sides were identical. And 4 oddly placed nail holes lined up with nail holes in Joyce and Hauptmann's attic. Condon's address and telephone number were written in pencil on a closet door in Hauptmann's home, and Hauptmann told police that he had written Condon's address. "I must have read it in the paper about the story. I was a little bit interested and keep a little bit of record of it. And maybe I was just in the closet and was reading the paper and put it down, the address. I can't give you any explanation about the telephone number." A sketch that Wilnitz suggested represented a ladder was found in one of Hauptmann's notebooks. Hauptmann said this picture and other sketches therein were the work of a child. Despite not having an obvious source of earned income, Hauptmann had bought a $400 radio, approximately equivalent to $7,640 today, and sent his wife on a trip to Germany. Hauptmann was identified as the man to whom the ransom money was delivered. Other witnesses testified that it was Hauptmann who had spent some of the Lindbergh gold certificates, that he had been seen in the area of the estate in East Amwell, New Jersey, near Hopewell, on the day of the kidnapping, and that he had been absent from work on the day of the ransom payment and had quit his job 2 days later. Hauptmann never sought another job afterward, yet continued to live comfortably. When the prosecution raised its case, the defense opened with a lengthy examination of Hauptmann. In his testimony, Hauptmann denied being guilty, insisting that the box of gold certificates had been left in his garage by a friend, Isidore Fitch, who had returned to Germany in December 1933 and died there in March 1934. Hauptmann said that he had one day found a shoebox left behind by Fitch, which Hauptmann had stored on the top shelf of his kitchen broom closet, later discovering the money which he later found to be almost $40,000, approximately equivalent to $609,000 in 2019. Hauptmann said that because Fitch had owed him about $7,500 in business funds, Hauptmann had kept the money for himself and had lived in it since January 1934. The defense called Hauptmann's wife, Anna, to corroborate with Fitch's story. On cross-examination, she admitted that while she hung her apron every day on a hook higher than the top shelf, she could not remember seeing any shoebox there. Later, rebuttal witnesses testified that Fitch could not have been at the scene of the crime and that he had no money for medical treatments when he died of tuberculosis. Fitch's landlady testified that he could barely afford the $3.50 weekly rent of his room. In his closing summation, Riley argued that the evidence against Hauptmann was entirely circumstantial because no reliable witnesses had placed Hauptmann at the scene of the crime, nor were his fingerprints found in the ladder or the ransom notes or anywhere in the nursery. And that's that. They go into appeals, and we'll get into the appeals area in the final chapter. Was that a cat? Was that furniture?
Yeah, it was kind of my cat.
Wow.
I hope it was.
It's like sounds of the wild. Woo, woo.
She is the most talkative cat ever.
Yeah.
I'm surprised she doesn't talk in every episode.
That's great.
She's very chatty.
So, but, yeah, thoughts.
Okay, there's just a lot. Like, okay, so back then, it just seems to me, if you're were going to do a crime like that, it would be not easy to get away with it necessarily, but not like today. You know, there's video cameras everywhere, yeah. And you know, you've got a phone and you're gonna ping off some tower, and like, it's just more complicated.
Yeah,
like you could take the money and just go someplace, like the guy he's blaming it on. Like, why wouldn't that guy, if he's going to Germany, take the money? They would, that's my cat again, they would take dollars there and give you, you know, they would exchange currencies if you had cash money.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a new thing.
And then,
like, why would you leave behind that kind of money? Then you could really get away with a crime.
Exactly. You could exchange all your money and you're out, you know, and you're in another country and you got your money still. And it's,
yeah. That just makes no sense that he would go all the way there and conveniently.
No.
For this guy, die, so nobody can ask him about it. It just, in all that evidence they have, I mean, that's some pretty good police work for back then.
Yeah. Is the motive only money? Is that the whole, I mean, I guess we'll
hell
get to that.
Yeah, that's about the motive for about 90% of crimes.
Yeah, that's true.
Is money.
Yeah.
In some way. It's just, but my God, to kill a child. Like, I don't even get that.
Why wouldn't they? If you're going to end up getting your ransom and shit, why would you kill the child? Why not give the child back? I mean, I guess you don't have to because you're a criminal and a horrible human being and you could get your money either way, but it's still, it's like, I don't
and he
know.
Killed the child right away. There was never, no. The child was ever going to come back.
That's how he had the clothes, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, God. Well, there is one more chapter to this, the final chapter, and we'll get into that. If you are a Darksider, you can sign up to be one at our website, darksideofwiki.com, or search Darkside of Wikipedia on Patreon. $5 a month gets you access to our final chapter segments of all of our episodes going forward, as well as our archive of episodes going way back to the beginning of the show. So there's tons and tons of content for you to binge away on. You also get advanced episodes of the show released to you months before the release to the public. All of it, final chapter, it's all there for you. So start binging. $5 a month keeps us on the air. So please do check that out. Darkside of Wiki, and click Become a Darksider to get the final chapter of today's episode of the program. Until next time, for Carol, I'm Tony. We'll see you in the final chapter.